This is the Crime Story Podcast with Carrie Antholis, where stories of crime and justice are told. On today's podcast, Crime Story's Sean Smith continues his weekly analysis of the news stories aggregated in Crime Story Daily related to COVID-19 and our carceral system. On this episode, we cover the week beginning July 5th. You can find this story in written form at crimestory.com.
Week 17, July 5 to 11. New daily cases of COVID-19 in the U.S. hit 48,606 Sunday, July 5, setting a record high for the 27th day in a row. Many faulted premature business reopenings throughout the South and Southwest. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego rued, quote, "We opened way too early in Arizona," end quote. Unexpected demand for tests prompted two major diagnostic companies, Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp, to caution that the turnaround time for COVID-19 test results had slowed from 1 or 2 days for the general population to anywhere from 2 to 6. Washington State Governor Jay Inslee was quick to connect the dots. Quote, "The labs have been slower. Why? It's because governors in southern states listened to Donald Trump, and they reopened their businesses way too fast, and they let thousands of people rush into bars, and as a result, they've got massive surges of pandemics in Texas and Florida and other states," end quote. As election year politics and pandemic priorities clashed across the country, Donald Trump opened yet another front in his COVID culture wars. Quote, "Corrupt Joe Biden and the Democrats don't want to open schools in the fall for political reasons, not health reasons. They think it will help them in November. Wrong. The people get it," end quote. K-12 students were the latest pawns in Trump's increasingly desperate quest for re-election. By week 17, it was evident that institutional resistance had won out over reform. Quote, "U.S. prisons and jails are opaque, crowded, filthy institutions where the preferred administrative pace is glacial," end quote, writes C.J. Kiramella in COVID-19 Pulls Back the Mask on America's Prison System, Reason, July 6. Quote, "They've been finely tuned over the past 50 years to resist outside oversight and sudden change," end quote. After roughly 120 days in lockdown, prisoners continued to bear the brunt of this intransigence. Rehabilitative programs and communications with family and attorneys were suspended. Already substandard medical care had deteriorated further, and containment and transfer strategies had failed. The carceral system had exhausted its limited reservoir of imagination and empathy, even as the pandemic continued to rage through its facilities. At local, state, and federal levels, decarceration efforts had largely ground to a halt. In It's Like a Horror Movie, Trapped Inside San Quentin During an Explosion of COVID-19, Mother Jones, July 8, criminal justice activist and excarcerate James King tells Madison Pauley, quote, "I want to know why large-scale releases are off the table. I want to know why they are not allowing science and medical advice to drive the decision-making," end quote. In Releasing People from Prison is Easier Said Than Done, The Atlantic, July 8, Barbara Bradley Haggerty concludes that, quote, "The risk of unleashing new violence into the community," end quote, torpedoed widespread promises of early release. She quotes John Pfaff, professor of law at Fordham University, who tells her, quote, "Governors are making a very calculating decision that it's probably better for them politically for 10 men to preventively die in prison from COVID than for one of them to do something wrong if he's released early. We don't view these deaths as all that problematic," end quote. The flip side of this ugly political calculus is an equally powerful concern, that by reducing the number of incarcerated bodies, the viability of the entire carceral system might be called into question. As Joe Newdell, Alex Cholas Wood, and Shared Goel argue in Cities and States Empty Jails to Prevent Infection, They Should Stay Empty, The Washington Post, July 7, pandemic-inspired reforms, from eliminating or reducing cash bail to easing certain probation requirements, are already being rolled back or rescinded. Quote, "These rollbacks may be the result of fear that reducing arrests and prosecutions inevitably drives an increase in crime, Some people apparently believe that reducing arrests might be okay during a public health emergency, but only then. But the data show that such reforms often have little, if any, negative effect on public safety. End quote. A major component in the intransigence of the carceral system, no doubt, is an institutional will to survive. Or, as Nicole Porter, Director of Advocacy for the Sentencing Project, tells Barbara Bradley Haggerty, quote, "What I hope this moment tells us is that our incarceration rate is a function of politics, because there are many questions about who needs to be incarcerated." End quote. Donald Trump politicizes testing and manipulates data, and his negative influence is discernible everywhere. In Inside the Prison, where 8 in 10 of the incarcerated have gotten coronavirus, HuffPost, July 9, COVID Prison Project co-founder Lauren Brinkley Rubenstein tells Jessica Schulberg that when prisons and jails limit testing, quote, "their case rates look really low, but it's really artificial because if you don't have testing in the door, there's no way to know what true prevalence is," end quote. Schulberg expands on this, concluding, quote, "Without a plan in place to meaningfully protect incarcerated people from the coronavirus, mass testing does little more than document the system's failures," end quote. In How U.S. Prisons Became Ground Zero for COVID-19, Politico, June 25, Taylor Miller Thomas contrasts testing initiatives in the Arizona and Michigan correctional systems. Quote, "As of May 22, Thomas notes, quote, "Michigan announced the state had tested every prisoner in the Department of Corrections system, while Arizona had tested 2.5% of the inmates in its custody," end quote. 8.6% of Michigan inmates tested positive, compared to 0.42% of all Arizona inmates. But by limiting testing for COVID-19, corrections systems are hardly restricting the ravages of the coronavirus, only denying them at their own peril. Quote, "We knew that people would point at us and say, oh, look at Michigan. It's got a huge problem. Look at all the COVID cases there," end quote. Michigan Department of Corrections spokesman Chris Gouts confides to Thomas. Quote, "But I think if every state were to have done mass testing like we did, I think Michigan wouldn't have stood out. I think every state is going to have cases. We just happen to know where ours are," end quote. Inadequate testing was certainly one of the reasons for the ill-advised decision by California's Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to transfer 121 inmates from the infected California Institution for Men in Chino to San Quentin. As readers of this weekly summary are aware, after the transfer, infection rates spiked at the Marin County facility, and at least 6 inmates died. Quote, "This disaster is most likely of the state's own making," end quote. Scott Shackford points out in San Quentin Prison's COVID-19 Deaths Highlight Officials' Inept Pandemic Response, Reason, July 7. Quote, "Few of the transferred prisoners had been tested for COVID-19 in the weeks before the transfer, and they weren't tested in San Quentin prior to being introduced to the prison population. In effect, the state's Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation may have created an outbreak where one did not previously exist, and people are dying because of it," end quote. As Richard Winton and Kim Christensen report in Top Medical Officer for California Prisons Ousted Amid Worsening Coronavirus Outbreak, the Los Angeles Times, July 6, the CDCR immediately implemented managerial changes to the state prison medical bureaucracy. Nevertheless, public health experts worried that the outbreak posed a threat to communities and medical facilities not only in the Bay Area, but statewide. Quote, "It's really shocking," unquote, Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco, observes. Quote, "It's scary. It's like a California wildfire, and you need to put it out, but putting it out is hard to do. And in the meantime, it's spreading," end quote. Watching from within San Quentin's walls is Adamu Chan, an incarcerated journalist. In The View from Inside San Quentin State Prison, Slate, July 6, Chan notes that the pandemic and extended lockdown are doing perhaps irreparable damage to the prison's creative arts community. With theater, writing, and music programs, among many others, on hold, Chan is concerned for his fellow artist incarcerates. Quote, "I worry about people whom society has labeled as violent or wrong and who were actively working to take on new identities and new ways of being. and that's being interrupted now. I worry about that." End quote. The transformative power of prison-produced art is the subject of Alex Greenberger's feature, "Incarcerated Artists Are Making Some of Today's Most Important Art. A Powerful New Book Explains Why." Art News, July 8. Greenberger interviews Nicole R. Fleetwood, author of "Marking Time, Art in the Age of Mass Incarceration," together with three formerly incarcerated artists, Tamika Cole, Russell Craig, and Jesse Crimes. A Philadelphia-based artist and curator, and co-founder of Right of Return USA, a national fellowship supporting formerly incarcerated artists, Crimes is explicit about the soul-crushing machinery of the carceral system. Quote, "The prison system is really designed to strip you of everything," he reflects. Quote, "They take you away from your family that you hold dear and love. They've tried to strip everything away from you and grind you down to the point where you buy into the idea that you are somehow not different, that you somehow don't have value, and that you are just a criminal. But the thing that artwork does is it allows you to create your own value system. It's the one thing that prison cannot take away from you." End quote. Crimes vows to use his art to promote conversations around defunding the police and carceral reform. Quote, "I'm trying to figure out a way, as an artist, to have something that keeps this issue visible, that keeps it in the public eye. People aren't invisible," he concludes, quote, "but they're behind walls, so it's easy to seem like the issue is faceless when it should be up front and a priority," end quote.
That was Sean Smith reading COVID-19 in Prison, a Crime Story series, part 17. For more storytelling news and narrative analysis in the world of crime and justice, head over to crimestory.com. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next Crime Story podcast.